Hello, and welcome back to the Glossy Week in Review podcast. I'm your host, senior fashion reporter Danny Parisi, and I'm here with our international reporter, Zofia Zviglinska. Hello, Zofia. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining. We have a fun episode this week talking about a lot of luxury stuff, but we're also going to talk about TikTok. So first, we'll talk about the ongoing fallout from Matches Fashion collapsing and kind of the impact on the luxury market. We'll also talk about luxury in general. This week had a very tough earnings week, particularly in Asia and China in particular. A lot of brands not doing so well in that region anymore, and we'll talk about why. And finally, we're going to talk about the TikTok ban, which is looking likelier by the day. We've already talked about it on the podcast before, sort of more preliminary, but now that it's like really picking up steam, we'll get into it a little bit more. Let's start, though, with Matches Fashion. So Matches Fashion was one of the several online luxury retail companies that in late 2023 were sort of imploding. It, along with Farfetch, to a lesser extent, Net-a-Porter, which has not collapsed, but is definitely still incurring a lot of losses. But Farfetch and Matches Fashion were both kind of sold off for very cheap last year. I think Matches was sold to Frasers for around $60 million, £52 million, $64 million, something around there. So that was all happening last year. The most recent bit of news is that it came out this week that Matches owes millions of dollars. I think they owe over $40 million to multiple luxury brands that it has not been able to pay. Gucci is owed like $500,000. I think Burberry as well. A Swedish brand called Totem is owed over $1 million. So it's just really in a tough spot. And I don't know if they're even going to be able to pay off all that debt. It really feels like that collapse was big and is now impacting all these brands. And, you know, same with Farfetch. It really feels like that whole market kind of fell apart at the end of last year. We talked about it more at the time, but Zofia, what are your thoughts on, I don't know, how Matches got into this situation or what this means for luxury e-commerce in general?
Yeah, so the UK has a very long and interesting history with Mike Ashley, who owns Matches or owned Matches as of recently. And it's quite well known that he ends up basically gutting businesses and then not supplying all of the rest of the kind of needed things for the brands. So he's been the owner of Frasers, which is a big kind of department store chain over here, which as of 4 hours ago, already saying that they're closing their Manchester office and possibly putting 100 jobs out of things. So I think that the Matches sale is just the kind of start of things. And I think that what's happening here is very typical Mike Ashley. Like, I don't think these brands will be repaid. I don't think that even the luxury brands, unless they've got it stipulated in contracts that they are owed that, most of the time, I think it's the debtors in terms of like the industry and the investors will be the ones who get paid off first. And then the brands will basically be the last ones to get any money at all. And then depending on, you know, the size of the brand, they're the ones who are going to get paid the most. So I would assume that Gucci and Burberry will be paid first and then other smaller brands will be paid last. So I think the question was, you know, especially around smaller brands, is will they even be able to get their stock back from Matches? Because obviously if they can do that, they might be able to sell it somewhere else. And I think even that is looking quite unlikely, that there's issues with handing over that stock. So yeah, the Matches situation in general is very classic Mike Ashley, and I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I think what I read is that they're only likely to pay back around $1 million worth of, like, out of the 40 to 100 that they maybe owe. And I think you're right. It's like, who gets paid first? It's not going to be the brands. It's going to be the executives. I think they said that they were paying out basically just like the bare essentials needed to keep the business, like, technically still alive. But I do think it's an interesting, I think it raises an interesting question of the trust that as a brand you kind of have to have in the platforms that you're working with, that they're not going to collapse, they're not going to fall apart, they're not going to take your stock or the money that you're owed with them. I remember back during the early days of the pandemic, there was a lot of grumbling from brands that I was talking to from about different retailers that had canceled their orders last minute and like sent stuff back, or kind of like this was income that they were really relying on, banking on that it was going to come through and help them stay afloat through the pandemic. And then the retailers just like dropped it, you know, really abruptly. Mm-hmm. And I remember that several people told me that that kind of shook their faith in working with, you know, an outside, like a wholesaler because of that. Like you're kind of basically when you're forming a wholesale partnership, if you're a brand and you're working with a retailer, whether it's a brick and mortar department store or like an online place like Mattress Fashion, you kind of have to cede a little bit of control of your future to them there, because they're going to sell your product. But then additionally, you're also like kind of tangled up with them now. And if something goes wrong with them, it affects you. So I do wonder if that will have any long-term impact on, say, like the balance between DTC and wholesale that a lot of brands do. I mean, it feels like every couple of weeks I hear from brands that they're actually looking at more direct. Like I just talked to Levi's the other day and they were saying that direct to consumer is a, you know, is their new focus. But then the next week I talked to a brand and they're like, actually, we're going back into wholesale. So it feels like there's constantly trying to figure out the right balance. But something like this, when a major retailer collapses and leaves you with a bunch of money they owe you and not paying it, like, I feel like that has to shake some faith a little bit and maybe turn some people back toward direct to consumer.
Yeah, definitely. I think that that's exactly what I'm seeing. And especially for luxury products, like you're leaving a lot of money on the table if you end up not selling that stock because of something like this, for example. So I think it makes a lot of sense for them to kind of cede back control and be very wary and kind of cautious around future wholesale partnerships, that either, you know, you bake it into the contract that the wholesaler has to return your stock, for example, or that, you know, you only give them a very small kind of limited amount of your collection so you don't end up losing, you know, a huge amount of money. But yeah, I think the wholesale question seems to be coming up kind of again and again. And I think that as there's more instability in the space, and, you know, I think it's like modus operandi is like the only one which is kind of surviving and thriving. It seems like all of the other wholesalers are kind of struggling on that front. And, you know, it's the same with kind of multi-brand retail. Like, it just seems like that whole multi-brand kind of environment is changing a lot. And I think it will affect, you know, how brands see it, you know, in terms of future partnerships.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And speaking of luxury, I feel like this does kind of, you know, lead into our second topic, which was going to be about how this week, you know, multiple luxury brands had their earnings and they all kind of saw similar things, which was lowered sales in general, which we've talked about a bunch, that the luxury market is kind of contracting a little bit. But specifically, a lot of them saw a slowdown in sales in China and Asia in general. I think Kering had, projected their profits to be down like 45% in the first half of the year, particularly because of Gucci and lowered sales in China. And the CFO of Gucci, Armelle Poulou, had a really interesting take on this that I wanted to talk about. So she said that basically the Chinese customer is very polarized at the moment between like ultra high end and the low end of the fashion spectrum. Basically, like, if they're going to buy something expensive, they're going to buy the most expensive thing. And if they're not, they're just going to go for something cheaper. And Gucci is definitely a luxury brand, but they are a little bit in the middle, maybe compared to something that's like super, super, super expensive. And I thought that was interesting because I've heard a little bit of the same thing from the US perspective. I don't know if it's like that in the UK or in Europe, but it does feel like that market condition in China is like kind of an advanced, maybe exaggerated version of some similar stuff that I've heard over here. I don't know. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. It's just like the customers are changing in a big way. And obviously the fact that a lot of these brands have raised their prices significantly, and also, you know, shifted creative directors, especially with Gucci, like that's a big kind of feature here. You know, it's very hard, I think, when a brand is still in that transitional kind of stage of things. From what I understand, like Sabato's collection is not even in stores, like only 7% of like the assortment is his stuff. So I think that really affects like how the brand does, what it looks like in terms of marketing. If, you know, customers are seeing one thing on social media, but they're not actually getting that in stores, like it ends up kind of affecting that brand image a little bit. And yeah, the China question, I think it's, again, like most of the time after the pandemic, Chinese like customers ended up relying on local brands, or at least kind of very localized content. I think that also pushed them a little bit further away from traditional luxury, which, you know, beforehand had a very kind of firm grasp on China. Like, you know, people wanted to buy Gucci, people wanted to buy like Chanel and Prada, and well, Prada, I think they still do. But in terms of the other brands, I think it's something that is still really tough for them to kind of figure out like how to approach China in the right way. And I think it's not at the scale that it was before. And I think that that scale is kind of lacking now. But my guess is it's more of a correction than anything else. Like, people expected way too much from it. And now they're seeing that actually, you know what, people are being more cautious than we think. And obviously the economic condition in China is also affecting things. Like, people just don't have crazy amounts of money like they used to, and they're very worried about their future prospects. So I think they're looking at, you know, keeping the money or investing it in other things other than the fashion.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And it makes me think that a lot of times, you know, whether a brand or a business in fashion succeeds or doesn't, a lot of it has to do with timing, you know, because if you're switching creative directors, I feel like that's always going to be a little bit of a lull, just while the new person is coming in and the old person, that's like, you know, there's this transition, and that's expected. But like, you don't want that to line up also with like a severe market contraction at the same time, because it's like, you know, you ideally would want that to happen in a nice, calm, safe period when it's okay to like, you know, have a quarter or two that's a little bit slower. But like, you can't predict that stuff that well, even though there's armies of people whose job it is to predict it. I feel like there's still unpredictable stuff all the time. I was also going to say, you mentioned Prada, and that's funny because I was going to mention them as the one brand that I was looking at this week that did not have a decrease in sales in China. So like, Zegna had like, they particularly had a drop at Thom Browne where the sales were like 35% lower. But the whole company was like, had lower sales in China. It's not just Kering. Multiple other brands have talked about this, except for Prada, who reported like an 18% increase in sales in China this week. And then I think a 46% increase in Japan, which is huge. So they're clearly doing something right there. And then Miu Miu in particular had like an 89% increase in sales, not just Asia, but like across the board. So it's kind of funny sometimes. I know it's, I don't know what got into Miu Miu that made them like grow so much in the last quarter, but it is fun. I'm like, that I also am thinking, like, I wonder if it's just like kind of the random like tides of the market sometimes. Like, I think Prada does great. I'm sure there's a lot of strategy involved with like, you know, how they approach the market in China, but it also just feels like, I don't know, maybe the customer just was into Prada this quarter. Like, you know what I mean? I can't always say exactly why Kering did bad and Prada did well in kind of the same market with sort of a similar product. I don't know if you had any perspective on that though.
Yeah, I mean, on the Japan front, I kind of predicted that last year that was going to happen, just because I feel like, honestly, the Japanese customer is much more stable in Asia than other ones. So China, I think, is a little bit more fickle, but I think Japan's really held out. And, you know, a lot of brands have done similar things or popped up in activations over there and been really successful. And a story that's actually come out today from me is all about how resale is growing over there, and how that is also popping up as a new kind of channel for brands that are looking for more sales opportunities in that region. On the Miu Miu front, I think it's because the brand is fun. I'm looking at all of these brands and I'm like, I don't know if any of these brands apart from Miu Miu have like a Gen Z appeal. And I think that Prada has some of it, which is kind of why the increase in sales over there. But I feel like Miu Miu actually, like, it seems like light and relevant to like the Gen Z audience. I feel like most of the other brands aren't. So I'm wondering if it's maybe just a lack of adequate strategy around that front. You know, you can only go on TikTok so many times, or, you know, pop up and do fun Reels videos. If the product itself isn't working for that customer group, then it just isn't. And I think a lot of the times those brands that do win out are actually really like surprising. I think we were talking about it, like Ed Hardy's popped back up again. Like, that's supposed to be a big one. And like, I see Miu Miu in that same boat. It's almost like a retro brand that's still got a lot of relevance for younger people. And yeah, I'm quite surprised by it, but at the same time, like, yeah, it makes sense.
It does. And actually, now that you've laid it out, I think I agree with you that having the sort of more fun, youthful appeal. And like, that's why it's funny with Gucci, like, I don't know, not to be too judgmental, but it's kind of funny. I feel like Alessandro Michele had this really specific style that was so recognizable. Mm. And then they were like, we're actually getting rid of that and we're just going to do something more boring. Like, I don't know, maybe that's too harsh, but I'm like, that feels like it would be such a like edge to have, like that fun, recognizable, flamboyant kind of style. Mm. I don't know. But we should move on to our last topic, which related to China is about the TikTok ban, which has been kind of floating around for a little while. Biden signed the bill into law this week, and there's a deadline now of January 19th for ByteDance to divest of TikTok in the U.S. ByteDance has said they're going to challenge it, obviously, which I believe we talked about at the time. I was like, there's no way this doesn't turn into like a long, protracted legal battle. So even if it does happen, I feel like it's not going to be for a year or more, because the like big companies are very capable of like backing things up in court and like making them take forever. So I have a feeling that it either comes to like a very quick resolution that sort of avoids the whole thing, or if it does go through, it's going to be like, you know, a year from now before it actually comes into effect. The thing that I wanted to talk about specifically about this is how the ban, or even just the looming presence of the ban, is affecting people's TikTok strategy. I was just talking to a brand last week who was saying they have a strong TikTok presence. They post on it all the time, but it's all kind of like off the cuff and organic. And they were saying, this executive was telling me that they were just on the verge of kind of like investing more. They were seeing a lot of success without investing that much. And then they were like, okay, we should put more money into this, hire people to like kind of like take on our TikTok kind of strategy more directly. And then right as they were planning this, like this bill came up, and now they're like kind of in limbo now, where they're like, do we want to really pour money into this right now, or should we wait? And so it's kind of like put their whole TikTok strategy, which was doing well, sort of on hold. Like, they're still using it. They're not like pausing their TikTok content production or anything, but it paused their kind of plans for further investment. And they're like, do we want to build a whole team around it, or should we wait? So it feels like the biggest impact at the moment for me is things like that. I feel like there's probably plenty of brands who are having the same thought of like, should we make any big changes to our TikTok strategy right now, or should we kind of wait and see what happens? I don't know if you've heard anything similar or if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's most likely going to be a wait and see approach. Like, because of the fact it's a bill and a law, any changes that will happen relatively slowly. So I think that even if there is a change in the decision or something ends up accelerating, brands will have enough time to shift their strategy. And I think that it makes the most sense to end up pouring all of that kind of content resources into Reels, or else YouTube Shorts, which have similar formats and like a growing audience as well. Like, from what I understand, you know, at least on the YouTube Shorts front, it seems like it's a very expanding thing, according to some sources at the dinner in London that was in here this week. And I think that a lot of people were actually talking about that.
Glossy Leaders Dinner.
Yeah, just the glossy leaders dinner. Yeah. A lot of people were talking about the TikTok ban because, obviously, how does that end up affecting the UK and TikTok Shop, which started in the UK before it was kind of launched in the US, and a lot of brands have been seeing some success with that. So I think that it's interesting to look at it in terms of, you know, what will brands do? But I think that most likely the movement will be so slow that brands will basically have enough time to shift over. I think at this point, it might make more sense to look into a more diversified strategy across Reels and YouTube Shorts rather than just pouring your money into TikTok. And then on the other side, obviously, you know, like TikTok Lite, which is meant to be this like experience that users get paid for when interacting with the app, that launched in Europe and Spain and France, has also seen pushback from the EU. And I believe that TikTok has pulled the whole thing. So they're not just facing a problem in the US now, they're also facing one in Europe. And it might lead to more kind of shutdowns and controls around TikTok in general. And I think that's why, you know, the parent company ByteDance is now asking luxury brands to come onto Douyin, which is really popular in China, and seeing if they might, you know, transition some of their ad spend and everything over onto that platform. So yeah, there's a whole shift happening over there.
Yeah, there's been kind of some reverse, you know, similar decisions going the other direction. The Chinese government taking some action against American tech companies. They just removed WhatsApp and Threads, which are both Meta apps, from the Chinese app store. I think the Apple App Store. So I feel like there's going to be a continued sort of proxy war through like tech platforms and social media, kind of like between geopolitical entities. The other thing is, I feel like we should mention that there's, even though there's some bipartisan support for the TikTok ban bill, what we call the TikTok ban, there's also, I feel like I've seen a lot of pushback from also, like, obviously from users who like TikTok and don't want it to go away or don't want it to, like, be altered significantly, but also from, like, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, have talked about how it, like, banning a social media app sets a dangerous precedent. You know, there's, I feel like there's a lot of pushback against the bill, not just from ByteDance. You know, there's a lot of third parties who have kind of considered it to be a very, like, strong arm sort of move. So I don't know. I'm definitely expecting a long legal battle. ByteDance said that they're confident that they can win this legal battle. I don't know if that's true. I'm not a legal expert, but I do know that I'm confident that they can make it last a very long time and maybe come up with some alternate solution while it's like being hammered out in court. Anyway, any other thoughts on the TikTok ban before we finish up?
Nope, that's everything for me.
Great. Well, Zofia, it's always great to have you. Thank you for being on the podcast this week.
Thank you so much. It was so fun.
And for those of you listening, don't forget to give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to this. That helps us out so much. And don't forget to subscribe to the Glossy Podcast, because you'll hear interviews with industry insiders every Wednesday and Week in Review episodes with me every Friday. Until then, thank you so much for listening.